the finance ministers of Israel and Iran were to meet for lunch, they would have a common economic language, and could easily understand and sympathize with each other's woes. When the Islamic State conquered large parts of Syria and Iraq, it murdered tens of thousands of people, demolished archaeological sites, toppled statues, and systematically destroyed the symbols of previous regimes and of Western cultural influence. But when its fighters entered the local banks and found stashes of American dollars there, covered with the faces of American presidents and with slogans in English praising American political and religious ideals, they did not burn these symbols of American imperialism. For the dollar bill is universally venerated across all political and religious divides. Though it has no intrinsic value, you cannot eat or drink a dollar bill. Trust in the dollar, and in the wisdom of the Federal Reserve, is so firm that it is shared even by Islamic fundamentalists, Mexican drug lords, and North Korean tyrants. Yet the homogeneity of contemporary humanity is most apparent when it comes to our view of the natural world and of the human body. If you fell sick 1,000 years ago, it mattered a great deal where you lived. In Europe, the resident priest would probably tell you that you had made God angry, and that in order to regain your health, you should donate something to the church, make a pilgrimage to a sacred site, and pray fervently for God's forgiveness. Alternatively, the village witch might explain that a demon had possessed you, and that she could cast it out using song, dance, and the blood of a black cockerel. In the Middle East, doctors brought up on classical traditions might explain that your four bodily humors were out of balance, and that you should harmonize them with a proper diet and foul-smelling potions. In India, Ayurvedic experts would offer their own theories concerning the balance between the three bodily elements known as doshas, and recommend a treatment of herbs, massages, and yoga postures. Chinese physicians, Siberian shamans, African witch doctors, Amerindian medicine men. Every empire, kingdom, and tribe had its own traditions and experts, each espousing different views about the human body and the nature of sickness, and each offering their own cornucopia of rituals, concoctions, and cures. Some of them worked surprisingly well, whereas others were little short of a death sentence. The only thing that united European, Chinese, African, and American medical practices was that everywhere at least a third of all children died before reaching adulthood, and average life expectancy was far below 50. Today, if you happen to be sick, it makes much less difference where you live. In Toronto, Tokyo, Tehran, or Tel Aviv, you will be taken to similar-looking hospitals, where you will meet doctors in white coats who learned the same scientific theories in the same medical colleges. They will follow identical protocols and use identical tests to reach very similar diagnoses. They will then dispense the same medicines produced by the same international drug companies. There are still some minor cultural differences, but Canadian, Japanese, Iranian, and Israeli physicians hold much the same views about the human body and human diseases. After the Islamic State captured Raqqa and Mosul, it did not tear down the local hospitals. Rather, it launched an appeal to Muslim doctors and nurses throughout the world to volunteer their services there. Presumably, even Islamist doctors and nurses believe that the body is made of cells, that diseases are caused by pathogens, and that antibiotics kill bacteria. And what makes up these cells and bacteria? Indeed, what makes up the entire world? 1,000 years ago, every culture had its own story about the universe and about the fundamental ingredients of the cosmic soup. Today, learned people throughout the world believe exactly the same things about matter, energy, time, and space. Take, for example, the Iranian and North Korean nuclear programs. The whole problem is that the Iranians and North Koreans have exactly the same view of physics as the Israelis and Americans. If the Iranians and North Koreans believed that E equals MC to the power of 4, Israel and the United States would not care an iota about their nuclear programs. People still have different religions and national identities. But when it comes to the practical stuff, how to build a state, an economy, a hospital, or a bomb, almost all of us belong to the same civilization. There are disagreements, no doubt, but then all civilizations have their internal disputes. Indeed, they are defined by these disputes. When trying to outline their identity, people often make a grocery list of common traits. That's a mistake. They would fare much better if they made a list of common conflicts and dilemmas. For example, in 1618, Europe didn't have a single religious identity. It was defined by religious conflict. To be a European in 1618 meant to obsess about tiny doctrinal differences between Catholics and Protestants, or between Calvinists and Lutherans, and to be willing to kill and be killed because of these differences. If a human being in 1618 did not care about these conflicts, that person was perhaps a Turk or a Hindu, but definitely not a European. Similarly, in 1940, Britain and Germany had very different political values, yet they were both part and parcel of European civilization. Hitler wasn't less European than Churchill. Rather, the very struggle between them defined what it meant to be European at that particular juncture in history. In contrast, a Kung hunter-gatherer in 1940 wasn't European because the internal European clash about race and empire would have made little sense to him. The people we fight most often are our own family members. Identity is defined by conflicts and dilemmas more than by agreement. What does it mean to be European in 2018? It doesn't mean to have white skin, to believe in Jesus Christ, or to uphold liberty. Rather, it means to argue vehemently about immigration, about the EU, and about the limits of capitalism. It also means to obsessively ask yourself, what defines my identity? And to worry about an aging population, about rampant consumerism, and about global warming. In their conflicts and dilemmas, 21st century Europeans are different from their ancestors in 1618 and 1940, but are increasingly similar to their Chinese and Indian trade partners. Whatever changes await us in the future, they are likely to involve a fraternal struggle within a single civilization, rather than a clash between alien civilizations. The big challenges of the 21st century will be global in nature. What will happen when climate change triggers ecological catastrophes? What will happen when computers outperform humans in more and more tasks and replace them in an increasing number of jobs? What will happen when biotechnology enables us to upgrade humans and extend lifespans? No doubt we will have huge arguments and bitter conflicts over these questions. But these arguments and conflicts are unlikely to isolate us from one another. Just the opposite. They will make us ever more interdependent. Though humankind is very far from constituting a harmonious community, we are all members of a single, rowdy, global civilization. How, then, to explain the nationalistic wave sweeping over much of the world? Perhaps in our enthusiasm for globalization, we have been too quick to dismiss the good old nations. Might a return to traditional nationalism be the solution to our desperate global crises? If globalization brings with it so many problems, why not just abandon it? 7. Nationalism. Global problems need global answers. Given that the whole of humankind now constitutes a single civilization, with all people sharing common challenges and opportunities, why do Britons, Americans, Russians, and numerous other groups turn toward nationalistic isolation? Does a return to nationalism offer real solutions to the unprecedented problems of our global world? Or is it an escapist indulgence that may doom humankind and the entire biosphere to disaster? In order to answer this question, we should first dispel a widespread myth. Contrary to common wisdom, nationalism is not a natural and eternal part of the human psyche, and it is not rooted in human biology. True, humans are social animals through and through, with group loyalty imprinted in their genes. However, for hundreds of thousands of years, Homo sapiens and its hominid ancestors lived in small, intimate communities numbering no more than a few dozen people. Humans easily develop loyalty to small, intimate groups, such as a tribe, an infantry company, or a family business. But it is hardly natural for humans to be loyal to millions of utter strangers. Such mass loyalties have appeared only in the last few thousand years, yesterday morning, in evolutionary terms, and they require immense efforts of social construction. People went to the trouble of constructing national collectives because they confronted challenges that could not be solved by any single tribe. Take, for example, the ancient tribes that lived along the Nile River thousands of years ago. The river was their lifeblood. It watered their fields and carried their commerce. But it was an unpredictable ally. Too little rain and people starved to death. Too much rain and the river overflowed its banks and destroyed entire villages. No tribe could solve this problem by itself, because each tribe commanded only a small section of the river and could mobilize no more than a few hundred laborers. Only a common effort to build huge dams and dig hundreds of miles of canals could hope to restrain and harness the mighty river. This was one of the reasons the tribes gradually coalesced into a single nation that had the power to build dams and canals, regulate the flow of the river, build grain reserves for lean years, and establish a countrywide system of transportation and communication. Despite such advantages, transforming tribes and clans into a single nation was never easy, either in ancient times or today. To realize how difficult it is to identify with such a nation, you just need to ask yourself, do I know these people? I can name my two sisters and 11 cousins and spend a whole day talking about their personalities, quirks, and relationships. I cannot name the 8 million people who share my Israeli citizenship. I have never met most of them, and I am very unlikely to ever meet them in the future. My ability to nevertheless feel loyal to this nebulous mass is not a legacy from my hunter-gatherer ancestors, but a miracle of recent history. A Martian biologist familiar only with the anatomy and evolution of Homo sapiens would never guess that these apes are capable of developing communal bonds with millions of strangers. In order to convince me to be loyal to Israel and its 8 million inhabitants, the Zionist movement and the Israeli state had to create a mammoth apparatus of education, propaganda, and flag-waving, as well as national systems of security, health, and welfare. That does not mean there is anything wrong with national bonds. Huge systems cannot function without mass loyalties, and expanding the circle of human empathy certainly has its merits. The milder forms of patriotism have been among the most benevolent of human creations. Believing that my nation is unique, that it deserves my allegiance, and that I have special obligations toward its members, inspires me to care about others and make sacrifices on their behalf. It is a dangerous mistake to imagine that without nationalism we would all be living in a liberal paradise. More likely, we would be living in tribal chaos. Peaceful, prosperous, and liberal countries, such as Sweden, Germany, and Switzerland, all enjoy a strong sense of nationalism. The list of countries lacking robust national bonds includes Afghanistan, Somalia, Congo, and most other failed states. The problem starts when benign patriotism morphs into chauvinistic ultra-nationalism. Instead of believing that my nation is unique, which is true of all nations, I might begin feeling that my nation is supreme, that I owe it my entire loyalty, and that I have no significant obligations to anyone else. This is fertile ground for violent conflicts. For generations, the most basic criticism of nationalism was that it led to war. Yet the link between nationalism and violence hardly curbed nationalist excesses, particularly as each nation justified its own military expansion by the need to protect itself against the machinations of its neighbors. As long as the nation provided most of its citizens with unprecedented levels of security and prosperity, they were willing to pay the price in blood. In the 19th and early 20th centuries, the nationalist deal still looked very attractive. Though nationalism was leading to horrendous conflicts on an unprecedented scale, modern nation-states also built massive systems of healthcare, education, and welfare. National health services made Passchendaele and Verdun seem worthwhile. Everything changed in 1945. The invention of nuclear weapons sharply tilted the balance of the nationalist deal. After Hiroshima, people no longer feared that nationalism would lead to mere war. They began fearing it would lead to nuclear war. total annihilation has a way of sharpening people's minds, and, thanks in no small measure to the atom bomb, the impossible happened, and the nationalist genie was squeezed at least halfway back into its bottle. Just as the ancient villagers of the Nile Basin redirected some of their loyalty from local clans to a much bigger kingdom that was able to restrain the dangerous river, so in the nuclear age, a global community gradually developed over and above the various nations, because only such a community could restrain the nuclear demon. In the 1964 U.S. presidential campaign, Lyndon B. Johnson aired the famous Daisy advertisement, one of the most successful pieces of propaganda in the annals of television. The advertisement opens with a little girl picking the petals of a daisy as she counts, but when she reaches 10, a metallic male voice takes over, counting back from 10 to 0 as in a missile countdown. Upon reaching 0, the bright flash of a nuclear explosion fills the screen. Then candidate Johnson addresses the American public and says, "These are the stakes. To make a world in which all of God's children can live, or to go into the dark. We must either love each other, or we must die." We tend to associate the "Make Love, Not War" slogan with the late 1960s counterculture. But in fact, in 1964, it was already accepted wisdom even among hard-nosed politicians such as Johnson. Consequently, during the Cold War, nationalism took a back seat to a more global approach to international politics, and when the Cold War ended, globalization seemed to be the irresistible wave of the future. It was expected that humankind would leave nationalistic politics completely behind, as a relic of more primitive times that might appeal at most to the ill-informed inhabitants of a few underdeveloped countries. Events in recent years have proved, however, that nationalism still has a powerful hold even on the citizens of Europe and the United States, not to mention Russia, India, and China. Alienated by the impersonal forces of global capitalism, and fearing for the fate of national systems of health, education, and welfare, people all over the world seek reassurance and meaning in the bosom of the nation. Yet the question raised by Johnson in the Daisy advertisement is even more pertinent today than it was in 1964. Will we make a world in which all humans can live together? Or will we all go into the dark? Do Donald Trump, Theresa May, Vladimir Putin, Narendra Modi, and their colleagues save the world by fanning our national sentiments? Or is the current nationalist spate a form of escapism from the intractable global problems we face? The Nuclear Challenge. Let's start with humankind's familiar nemesis, nuclear war. When the Daisy advertisement aired in 1964, 2 years after the Cuban Missile Crisis, nuclear annihilation was a palpable threat. Pundits and laypeople alike feared that humankind did not have the wisdom to avert destruction, and that it was only a matter of time before the Cold War turned scorching hot. In fact, humankind successfully rose to the nuclear challenge. Americans, Soviets, Europeans, and Chinese changed the way geopolitics had been conducted for millennia. So the Cold War ended with little bloodshed, and a new internationalist world order fostered an era of unprecedented peace. Not only was nuclear war averted, but war of all kinds declined. Since 1945, surprisingly few borders have been redrawn through naked aggression, and most countries have ceased using war as a standard political tool. In 2016, despite wars in Syria, Ukraine, and several other hotspots, fewer people died from human violence than from obesity, car accidents, or suicide. This may well have been the greatest political and moral achievement of our times. Unfortunately, by now we are so used to this achievement that we take it for granted. This is partly why people allow themselves to play with fire. Russia and the United States have recently embarked on a new nuclear arms race, developing novel doomsday machines that threaten to undo the hard-won gains of the last decades and bring us back to the brink of nuclear annihilation. Meanwhile, the public has learned to stop worrying and love the bomb, as suggested in Dr. Strangelove, or has just forgotten about its existence. This is why the Brexit debate in Britain, a major nuclear power, revolved mainly around questions of economics and immigration, while the vital contribution of the EU to European and global peace has largely been ignored. After centuries of terrible bloodshed, French, Germans, Italians, and Britons have finally built a mechanism that ensures continental harmony, only to have the British public throw a wrench into the miracle machine. It was extremely difficult to construct the internationalist regime that prevented nuclear war and safeguarded global peace. No doubt we need to adapt this regime to the changing conditions of the world, for example by relying less on the United States and granting a greater role to non-Western powers such as China and India. But abandoning this regime altogether and reverting to nationalist power politics would be an irresponsible gamble. True, in the 19th century, countries played the nationalist game without destroying human civilization, but that was in the pre-Hiroshima era. Since then, nuclear weapons have raised the stakes and changed the fundamental nature of war and politics. As long as humans know how to enrich uranium and plutonium, their survival depends on privileging the prevention of nuclear war over the interests of any particular nation. Zealous nationalists who cry, "Our country first," should ask themselves whether their country by itself, without a robust system of international cooperation, can protect the world, or even itself, from nuclear destruction. The ecological challenge. On top of nuclear war, in the coming decades, humankind will face a new existential threat that hardly registered on political radars in 1964. Ecological collapse. Humans are destabilizing the global biosphere on multiple fronts. We are taking more and more resources out of the environment while pumping back into it enormous quantities of waste and poison, thereby changing the composition of the soil, the water, and the atmosphere. We are hardly even aware of the myriad ways in which we disrupt the delicate ecological balance that has been shaped over millions of years. Consider, for example, the use of phosphorus as a fertilizer. In small quantities, it is an essential nutrient for the growth of plants. But in excessive amounts, it becomes toxic. Modern industrial farming is based on artificially fertilizing the fields with plenty of phosphorus, but the high phosphorus runoff from the farms subsequently poisons rivers, lakes, and oceans, with a devastating impact on marine life. A farmer growing corn in Iowa might thus inadvertently kill fish in the Gulf of Mexico. As a result of such activities, habitats are degraded, animals and plants are becoming extinct, and entire ecosystems, such as the Great Barrier Reef off Australia and the Amazon rainforest, might be destroyed. For thousands of years, Homo sapiens behaved as an ecological serial killer. Now, it is morphing into an ecological mass murderer. If we continue with our present course, it will not just cause the annihilation of a large percentage of all life forms, but also might sap the foundations of human civilization. Most threatening of all is the prospect of climate change. Humans have been around for hundreds of thousands of years and have survived numerous ice ages and warm spells. However, agriculture, cities, and complex societies have existed for no more than 10,000 years. During this period, known as the Holocene, Earth's climate has been relatively stable. Any deviation from Holocene standards will present human societies with enormous challenges they have never encountered before. It will be like conducting an open-ended experiment on billions of human guinea pigs. Even if human civilization eventually adapts to the new conditions, who knows how many victims might perish in the process of adaptation? This terrifying experiment has already been set in motion. Unlike nuclear war, which is a future potential, climate change is a present reality. There is a scientific consensus that human activities, in particular the emission of greenhouse gases such as carbon dioxide, are causing the Earth's climate to change at a frightening rate. Nobody knows exactly how much carbon dioxide we can continue to pump into the atmosphere without triggering an irreversible cataclysm. But our best scientific estimates indicate that unless we dramatically cut the emission of greenhouse gases in the next 20 years, average global temperatures will increase by more than 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, resulting in expanding deserts, disappearing ice caps, rising oceans, and more frequent extreme weather events such as hurricanes and typhoons. These changes in turn will disrupt agricultural production, inundate cities, make much of the world uninhabitable, and send hundreds of millions of refugees in search of new homes. Moreover, we are rapidly approaching a number of tipping points, beyond which even a dramatic drop in greenhouse gas emissions will not be enough to reverse the trend and avoid a worldwide tragedy. For example, as global warming melts the polar ice sheets, less sunlight is reflected back from planet Earth to outer space. This means that the planet absorbs more heat, temperatures rise even higher, and the ice melts even faster. Once this feedback loop crosses a critical threshold, it will gather an unstoppable momentum, and all the ice in the polar regions will melt even if humans stop burning coal, oil, and gas. Therefore, it is not enough that we recognize the danger we face. It is critical that we actually do something about it now. Unfortunately, as of 2018, instead of a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions, the global emission rate is still increasing. Humanity has very little time left to wean itself from fossil fuels. We need to enter rehab today. Not next year or next month, but today. Hello, I am Homo sapiens, and I am a fossil fuel addict. Where does nationalism fit into this alarming picture? Is there a nationalist answer to the ecological menace? Can any nation, however powerful, stop global warming by itself? Individual countries can certainly adopt a variety of green policies, many of which make good economic as well as environmental sense. Governments can tax carbon emissions, add the cost of externalities to the price of oil and gas, adopt stronger environmental regulations, cut subsidies to polluting industries, and incentivize the switch to renewable energy. They can also invest more money in researching and developing revolutionary eco-friendly technologies in a kind of ecological Manhattan Project. The internal combustion engine is to be thanked for many of the advancements of the last 150 years, but if we are to keep a stable physical and economic environment, it must now be retired and substituted by new technologies that do not burn fossil fuels. Technological breakthroughs can be helpful in many other fields besides energy. Consider, for example, the potential of developing clean meat. At present, the meat industry not only inflicts untold misery on billions of sentient beings, but is also one of the chief causes of global warming, one of the main consumers of antibiotics and poison, and one of the foremost polluters of air, land, and water. According to a 2013 report by the Institution of Mechanical Engineers, it takes nearly 4,000 gallons of fresh water to produce a little over 2 pounds of beef, compared to the 75 gallons needed to produce the same weight of potatoes. The pressure on the environment is likely to get worse as rising prosperity in countries such as China and Brazil allows hundreds of millions of additional people to switch from eating potatoes to eating beef on a regular basis. It would be difficult to persuade the Chinese and the Brazilians, not to mention the Americans and the Germans, to stop eating steaks, hamburgers, and sausages. But what if engineers could find a way to grow meat from cells? If you want a hamburger, just grow a hamburger, instead of raising and slaughtering an entire cow and transporting the carcass thousands of miles. This might sound like science fiction, but the world's first clean hamburger was grown from cells and then eaten in 2013. It cost $330,000. 4 years of research and development brought the price down to $11 per unit, and within another decade, industrially produced clean meat is expected to be cheaper than slaughtered meat. This technological development could save billions of animals from a life of abject misery, could help feed billions of malnourished humans, and could simultaneously help to prevent ecological meltdown. There are many things that governments, corporations, and individuals can do to avoid climate change. But to be effective, they must be done on a global level. When it comes to climate, countries are just not sovereign. They are at the mercy of actions taken by people on the other side of the planet. The Republic of Kiribati, an island nation in the Pacific Ocean, could reduce its greenhouse gas emissions to zero, and nevertheless be submerged under the rising waves if other countries don't follow suit. Chad could put a solar panel on every roof in the country, and yet become a barren desert due to the irresponsible environmental policies of distant foreigners. Even powerful nations, such as China and Japan, are not ecologically sovereign. To protect Shanghai, Hong Kong, and Tokyo from destructive floods and typhoons, the Chinese and Japanese will have to persuade the Russian and American governments to abandon their business-as-usual approach. Nationalist isolationism is probably even more dangerous in the context of climate change than nuclear war. An all-out nuclear war threatens to destroy all nations, so all nations have an equal stake in preventing it. Global warming, in contrast, will probably have different impacts on different nations. Some countries, most notably Russia, might actually benefit from it. Because Russia has relatively few coastline assets, it is far less worried than China or Kiribati about rising sea levels. And whereas higher temperatures are likely to turn Chad into a desert, they might simultaneously turn Siberia into the breadbasket of the world. Moreover, as the ice melts in the far north, the Russian-dominated Arctic sea lanes might become the artery of global commerce, and Kamchatka might replace Singapore as the crossroad of the world. Similarly, replacing fossil fuels with renewable energy sources is likely to appeal to some countries more than to others. China, Japan, and South Korea depend on importing huge quantities of oil and gas. They will be delighted to be free of that burden. Russia, Iran, and Saudi Arabia depend on exporting oil and gas. Their economies will collapse if oil and gas suddenly give way to solar and wind. Consequently, while some nations, such as China, Japan, and Kiribati, are likely to push hard for reducing global carbon emissions as soon as possible, other nations, such as Russia and Iran, might be far less enthusiastic. Even in countries that stand to lose much from global warming, such as the United States, nationalists might be too short-sighted and self-absorbed to appreciate the danger. A small but telling example occurred in January 2018, when the United States announced a 30% tariff on foreign-made solar panels and solar equipment, preferring to support American solar producers even at a cost of slowing the switch to renewable energy. An atom bomb is such an obvious and immediate threat that nobody can ignore it. Global warming, in contrast, is a more vague and protracted menace. Therefore, whenever long-term environmental considerations demand some painful short-term sacrifice, nationalists might be tempted to put immediate national interests first and reassure themselves that they can worry about the environment later, or just leave it to people elsewhere. Alternatively, they may simply deny the problem. It isn't a coincidence that skepticism about climate change tends to be the preserve of the nationalist right. You rarely see left-wing socialists tweet that climate change is a Chinese hoax. Since there is no national answer to the problem of global warming, some nationalist politicians prefer to believe the problem does not exist. The technological challenge. The same dynamics are likely to spoil any nationalist antidote to the third existential threat of the 21st century, technological disruption. As we saw in earlier chapters, the merger of infotech and biotech opens the door to a cornucopia of doomsday scenarios, ranging from digital dictatorships to the creation of a global useless class. What is the nationalist answer to these menaces? There is no nationalist answer. As in the case of climate change, so also with technological disruption. The nation-state is simply the wrong framework with which to address the threat. Since research and development are not the monopoly of any one country, even a superpower such as the United States cannot restrict them by itself. If the US government forbids genetically engineering human embryos, this doesn't prevent Chinese scientists from doing so. And if the resulting developments confer on China some crucial economic or military advantage, the United States will be tempted to break its own ban. Particularly in a xenophobic dog-eats-dog world, If even a single country chooses to pursue a high-risk, high-gain technological path, other countries will be forced to do the same, because nobody can afford to remain behind. In order to avoid such a race to the bottom, humankind will probably need some kind of global identity and loyalty. Moreover, whereas nuclear war and climate change threaten only the physical survival of humankind, disruptive technologies might change the very nature of humanity and are therefore entangled with humans' deepest ethical and religious beliefs. While everyone agrees that we should avoid nuclear war and ecological meltdown, people have widely different opinions about using bioengineering and AI to upgrade humans and to create new life forms. If humankind fails to devise and administer globally accepted ethical guidelines, it will be open season for Dr. Frankenstein. When it comes to formulating such ethical guidelines, nationalism suffers above all from a failure of the imagination. Nationalists think in terms of territorial conflicts lasting centuries, while the technological revolutions of the 21st century should really be understood in cosmic terms. After 4 billion years of organic life evolving by natural selection, science is ushering in the era of inorganic life shaped by intelligent design. In the process, Homo sapiens itself will likely disappear. Today, we are still apes of the hominid family. We still share most of our bodily structures, physical abilities, and mental faculties with Neanderthals and chimpanzees. Not only are our hands, eyes, and brains distinctly hominid, but so are our lust, our love, our anger, and our social bonds. Within a century or two, the combination of biotechnology and AI might result in physical and mental traits that completely break free of the hominid mold. Some believe that consciousness might even be severed from any organic structure and could surf cyberspace free of all biological and physical constraints. On the other hand, we might witness the complete decoupling of intelligence from consciousness, and the development of AI might result in a world dominated by super-intelligent but completely non-conscious entities. What does Israeli, Russian, or French nationalism have to say about this? In order to make wise choices about the future of life, we need to go way beyond the nationalist viewpoint and look at things from a global or even a cosmic perspective. Spaceship Earth. Each of these three problems, nuclear war, ecological collapse, and technological disruption, is enough to threaten the future of human civilization. But, taken together, they add up to an unprecedented existential crisis, especially because they are likely to reinforce and compound one another. For example, although the ecological crisis threatens the survival of human civilization as we have known it, it is unlikely to stop the development of AI and bioengineering. If you are counting on rising oceans, dwindling food supplies, and mass migrations to divert our attention from algorithms and genes, think again. As the ecological crisis deepens, the development of high-risk, high-gain technologies will probably only accelerate. Indeed, climate change may well come to perform the same function as the two world wars. Between 1914 and 1918, and again between 1939 and 1945, the pace of technological development skyrocketed, because nations engaged in total war threw caution and economy to the wind and invested immense resources in all kinds of audacious and fantastic projects. Many of these projects failed, but some produced tanks, radar, poison gas, supersonic jets, intercontinental ballistic missiles, and nuclear bombs. Similarly, nations facing a climate cataclysm might be tempted to invest their hopes in desperate technological gambles. Humankind has a lot of justifiable concerns about AI and bioengineering, but in times of crisis, people do risky things. Whatever you think about regulating disruptive technologies, ask yourself whether these regulations are likely to hold even if climate change causes global food shortages, floods cities all over the world, and sends hundreds of millions of refugees across borders. In turn, technological disruptions might increase the danger of apocalyptic wars, not just by increasing global tensions, but also by destabilizing the nuclear balance of power. Since the 1950s, superpowers avoided conflicts with one another because they all knew that war meant mutually assured destruction. But as new kinds of offensive and defensive weapons appear, a rising technological superpower might conclude that it can destroy its enemies with impunity. Conversely, a declining power might fear that its traditional nuclear weapons might soon become obsolete, and that it had better use them before it loses them. Traditionally, nuclear confrontations resembled a hyper-rational chess game. What would happen when players could use cyber-attacks to wrest control of a rival's pieces? When anonymous third parties could move a pawn without anyone knowing who was making the move? Or when Alpha Zero graduates from ordinary chess to nuclear chess? Just as the different challenges are likely to compound one another, so also the goodwill necessary to confront one challenge may be sapped by problems on another front. Countries locked in armed competition are unlikely to agree on restricting the development of AI, and countries striving to outstrip the technological achievements of their rivals will find it very difficult to agree on a common plan to stop climate change. As long as the world remains divided into rival nations, it will be very hard to simultaneously overcome all three challenges, and failure on even a single front might prove catastrophic. To conclude, the nationalist wave sweeping across the world cannot return the world to 1939 or 1914. Technology has changed everything by creating a set of global existential threats that no nation can solve on its own. A common enemy is the best catalyst for forging a common identity, and humankind now has at least three such enemies: nuclear war, climate change, and technological disruption. If, despite these common threats, humans choose to privilege their particular national loyalties above everything else, the results may be far worse than in 1914 and 1939. A much better path is the one outlined in the European Union's constitution, which says that, while remaining proud of their own national identities and history, the peoples of Europe are determined to transcend their former divisions and, united ever more closely, to forge a common destiny. This does not mean abolishing all national identities, abandoning all local traditions, and turning humanity into a homogeneous grey goo. Nor does it mean vilifying all expressions of patriotism. Indeed, by providing a continental military and economic protective shell, the European Union arguably fostered local patriotism in places such as Flanders, Lombardy, Catalonia, and Scotland. The idea of establishing an independent Scotland or Catalonia looks more attractive when you don't have to fear a German invasion, and when you can count on a common European front against global warming and global corporations. European nationalists are therefore taking it easy. For all the talk of the return of the nation, few Europeans are actually willing to kill and be killed for it. When the Scots sought to break away from London's grip in the days of William Wallace and Robert Bruce, they had to raise an army to do so. In contrast, not a single person was killed during the 2014 Scottish referendum, and if next time Scots do vote for independence, it is highly unlikely that they will have to restage the Battle of Bannockburn. The Catalan attempt to break away from Spain has resulted in considerably more violence, but it too falls far short of the carnage Barcelona experienced in 1939 or in 1714. The rest of the world can learn from the European example. Even on a united planet, there will be plenty of room for the kind of patriotism that celebrates the uniqueness of my nation and stresses my special obligations toward it. Yet, if we want to survive and flourish, humankind has little choice but to complement such local loyalties with substantial obligations toward a global community. A person can and should be loyal simultaneously to her family, her neighborhood, her profession, and her nation. So why not add humankind and planet Earth to that list? True, when you have multiple loyalties, conflicts are sometimes inevitable. But then, who said life was simple? Deal with it. In previous centuries, national identities were forged because humans faced problems and opportunities that were far beyond the scope of local tribes, and which only countrywide cooperation could hope to handle. In the 21st century, nations find themselves in the same situation as the old tribes. They are no longer the right framework to manage the most important challenges of the age. We need a new global identity because national institutions are incapable of handling a set of unprecedented global predicaments. We now have a global ecology, a global economy, and a global science, but we are still stuck with only national politics. This mismatch prevents the political system from effectively countering our main problems. To have effective politics, either we must de-globalize the ecology, the economy, and the march of science, or we must globalize our politics. Since it is impossible to de-globalize the ecology and the march of science, and since the cost of de-globalizing the economy would probably be prohibitive, the only real solution is to globalize politics. This does not mean establishing a global government, a doubtful and unrealistic vision. Rather, to globalize politics means that political dynamics within countries and even cities should give far more weight to global problems and interests. Nationalist sentiments are unlikely to be of much help in that. Perhaps, then, we can rely on the universal religious traditions of humankind to help us unite the world. Hundreds of years ago, religions such as Christianity and Islam already thought in global rather than local terms, and they were always keenly interested in the big questions of life rather than just in the political struggles of this or that nation. But are traditional religions still relevant? Do they retain the power to shape the world? Or are they just inert relics from our past, tossed here and there by the mighty forces of modern states, economies, and technologies? 8. Religion. God now serves the nation. So far, modern ideologies, scientific experts, and national governments have failed to create a viable vision for the future of humanity. Can such a vision be drawn from the deep wells of human religious traditions? Maybe the answer has been waiting for us all along in the pages of the Bible, the Quran, or the Vedas. Secular people are likely to react to this idea with ridicule or apprehension. Holy scriptures may have been relevant in the Middle Ages, but how can they guide us in an era of artificial intelligence, bioengineering, global warming, and cyber warfare? Yet secular people are a minority. Billions of humans still profess greater faith in the Quran and the Bible than in the theory of evolution. Religious movements shape the politics of countries as diverse as India, Turkey, and the United States. And religious animosities fuel conflicts from Nigeria to the Philippines. So how relevant are religions such as Christianity, Islam, and Hinduism? Can they help us solve the major problems we face? To understand the role of traditional religions in the world of the 21st century, we need to distinguish between three types of problems. 1. Technical problems. For example, how should farmers in arid countries deal with severe droughts caused by global warming? 2. Policy problems. For example, what measures should governments adopt to prevent global warming in the first place? 3. Identity problems. For example, should I even care about the problems of farmers on the other side of the world? Or should I care only about problems of people from my own tribe and country? As we shall see in the following pages, traditional religions are largely irrelevant to technical and policy problems. In contrast, they are extremely relevant to identity problems, but in most cases they constitute a major part of the problem rather than a potential solution. Technical problems. Christian agriculture. In pre-modern times, religions were responsible for solving a wide range of technical problems in mundane areas such as agriculture. Divine calendars determined when to plant and when to harvest, while temple rituals secured rainfall and protected against pests. When an agricultural crisis loomed due to drought or a plague of locusts, farmers turned to the priests to intercede with the gods. Medicine, too, fell within the religious domain. Almost every prophet, guru, and shaman doubled as a healer. Jesus, for example, spent much of his time healing the sick, helping the blind to see, granting speech to the mute, and making the mad sane. Whether you lived in ancient Egypt or in medieval Europe, if you were ill, you were likely to go to the witch doctor rather than to the doctor, and to make a pilgrimage to a renowned temple rather than to a hospital. In recent times, biologists and surgeons have taken over from priests and miracle workers. If Egypt is now struck by a plague of locusts, Egyptians may well ask Allah for help. Why not? But they will not forget to call upon chemists, entomologists, and geneticists to develop stronger pesticides and insect-resistant wheat strains. If the child of a devout Hindu suffers from a severe case of measles, the father will say a prayer to Dhanvantari and offer flowers and sweets at the local temple, but only after he has rushed the toddler to the nearest hospital and entrusted him to the care of the doctors there. Even mental illness, the last bastion of religious healers, is gradually passing into the hands of scientists as neurology replaces demonology and Prozac supplants exorcism. The victory of science has been so complete that our very idea of religion has changed. We no longer associate religion with farming and medicine. Even many zealots now suffer from collective amnesia and prefer to forget that traditional religions ever laid claim to those domains. So what if we turn to engineers and doctors, say the zealots? That proves nothing. What has religion got to do with agriculture or medicine in the first place? Traditional religions have lost so much turf because, frankly, they just weren't very good at farming or healthcare. The true expertise of priests and gurus has never really been rainmaking, healing, prophecy, or magic. Rather, it has always been interpretation. A priest is not somebody who knows how to perform the rain dance and end the drought. A priest is somebody who knows how to justify why the rain dance failed and why we must keep believing in our God, even though he seems deaf to all our prayers. Yet it is precisely their genius for interpretation that puts religious leaders at a disadvantage when they compete against scientists. Scientists, too, know how to cut corners and twist the evidence, but in the end, the mark of science is the willingness to admit failure and try a different tack. That's why scientists gradually learn how to grow better crops and make better medicines, whereas priests and gurus learn only how to make better excuses. Over the centuries, even the true believers have noticed the difference, which is why religious authority has been dwindling in more and more technical fields. This is also why the entire world has increasingly become a single civilization. When things really work, everybody adopts them. Policy problems. Muslim economics. While science provides us with clear-cut answers to technical questions such as how to cure measles, there is considerable disagreement among scientists about questions of policy. Almost all scientists concur that global warming is a fact, but there is no consensus regarding the best economic reaction to this threat. That does not mean, however, that traditional religions can help us resolve the issue. Ancient scriptures are just not good guides for modern economics, and the main fault lines, for example, between capitalists and socialists, don't correspond to the divisions between traditional religions. True, in countries such as Israel and Iran, rabbis and ayatollahs have a direct say about the government's economic policy, and even in more secular countries, such as the United States and Brazil, religious leaders influence public opinion on matters ranging from taxation to environmental regulations. Yet a closer look reveals that in most of these cases, traditional religions really play second fiddle to modern scientific theories. When Ayatollah Khomeini needs to make a crucial decision about the Iranian economy, he will not be able to find the necessary answer in the Quran, because 7th century Arabs knew very little about the problems and opportunities of modern industrial economies and global financial markets. So he, or his aides, must turn to Karl Marx, Milton Friedman, Friedrich Hayek, and the modern science of economics to get answers. having made up his mind to raise interest rates, lower taxes, privatize government monopolies, or sign an international tariff agreement, Khomeini can then use his religious knowledge and authority to wrap the scientific answer in the garb of this or that Quranic verse and present it to the masses as the will of Allah. But the garb matters little. When you compare the economic policies of Shiite Iran, Sunni Saudi Arabia, Jewish Israel, Hindu India, and Christian America, you just don't see that much of a difference. During the 19th and 20th centuries, Muslim, Jewish, Hindu, and Christian thinkers railed against modern materialism, soulless capitalism, and the excesses of the bureaucratic state. They promised that if only they were given a chance, they would solve all the ills of modernity and establish a completely different socio-economic system based on the eternal spiritual values of their creed. Well, they have been given quite a few chances, and the only noticeable change they have made to the edifice of modern economies is to redo the paint and place a huge crescent, cross, Star of David, or Om on the roof. Just as in the case of rainmaking, so also when it comes to economics. It is the long-honed expertise of religious scholars in reinterpreting texts that makes religion irrelevant. No matter which economic policy Khomeini chooses, he can always square it with the Quran. Therefore, the Quran is degraded from a source of true knowledge to a source of mere authority. When you face a difficult economic dilemma, you read Marx and Hayek closely, and they help you understand the economic system better, see things from a new angle, and think about potential solutions. Having formulated an answer, you then turn to the Quran and read it closely in search of some surah that, if interpreted imaginatively enough, can justify the solution you got from Hayek or Marx. No matter what solution you find there, if you are a good Quranic scholar, you will always be able to justify it. The same is true of Christianity. A Christian may be a capitalist as easily as a socialist, and even though a few things Jesus said smack of downright communism, during the Cold War, good American capitalists went on reading the Sermon on the Mount without taking much notice. There is just no such thing as Christian economics, Muslim economics, or Hindu economics. Not that there aren't any economic ideas in the Bible, the Quran, or the Vedas. It is just that these ideas are not up to date. Mahatma Gandhi's reading of the Vedas caused him to envision independent India as a collection of self-sufficient agrarian communities, each spinning its own khadi cloth, exporting little and importing even less. The most famous photograph of him shows him spinning cotton with his own hands, and he made the humble spinning wheel the symbol of the Indian nationalist movement. Yet this Arcadian vision was simply incompatible with the realities of modern economics, and for that reason not much has remained of it, save for Gandhi's radiant image on billions of rupee notes. Modern economic theories are so much more relevant than traditional dogmas that it has become common to interpret even ostensibly religious conflicts in economic terms, whereas nobody thinks of doing the reverse. For example, some argue that the troubles in Northern Ireland, between Catholics and Protestants, were fueled largely by class conflict. Due to various historical accidents, in Northern Ireland the upper classes were mostly Protestant, and the lower classes were mostly Catholic. Therefore, what seems at first sight to have been a theological conflict about the nature of Christ was in fact a typical struggle between haves and have-nots. In contrast, very few people would claim that the conflicts between communist guerrillas and capitalist landowners in South America in the 1970s were really just a cover for a far deeper disagreement about Christian theology. So what difference would religion make when facing the big questions of the 21st century? Take the question of whether to grant AI the authority to make decisions about people's lives, choosing what you should study, where you should work, and whom you should marry. What is the Muslim position on that question? What is the Jewish position? There are no Muslim or Jewish positions here. Humankind is likely to be divided into two main camps, those in favor of giving AI significant authority, and those opposed to it. Muslims and Jews are likely to be found in both camps, and to justify whichever position they espouse, through imaginative interpretations of the Quran and the Talmud. Of course, religious groups might harden their views on particular issues and turn them into allegedly sacred and eternal dogmas. In the 1970s, theologians in Latin America came up with liberation theology, which made Jesus look a bit like Che Guevara.